Welcome. How's everybody doing?
Great, Dave. How are you doing?
Great. Looking forward to your roadmap. Thanks for sending it around. That's really some outstanding work.
Well, good. I didn't know if you had any comment to it or...
Well, you know, I'm sorry I didn't get back to commenting to you. I think it was very thorough and very impressive, and I look forward to hearing you present it.
Oh, good.
Updates or wins and progress notes from you?
And really, for me, we've just been, you know, work's just been, year closes out, it just gets to be very busy, very stressful, so.
You sound a little tired. I bet it is a big push here at the end, huh?
Well, it's funny. About the past 30 minutes, I've been downstairs gargling like crazy with hot water because I've had, or salt water, because I've basically had no voice most of the day, so.
Oh, wow.
It's a little bit, hopefully long enough to get through this today.
Yeah, okay. Well, I won't push you for any long elaborations here until we get to your thing. Who else wants to check in? I know we have a couple of people additionally, so anybody want to check in?
This is Kat. I'll say hi.
Yeah,
hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
How's everything going for you?
Everything's going really well. I will say that I had an opportunity to do the roadmap with someone else this week, and I took into consideration what you said and really chunked down for this particular individual to get them to plan for the future instead of looking at the big picture, which is frustrating for some people. This particular individual really needed to have it chunked down by almost an hour basis.
Mm.
So... we discussed that last week, and I used that this week, and it was really effective.
Well, good. You know, sometimes what looks like resistance is simply an ambiguity because people are looking at such a big picture, they don't know exactly what to do next. So when we really begin to focus and shrink the change and focus on something tangible and specific and proximate, that it can be very useful. So good. I'm glad that was helpful. It sounds like a creative and flexible adaptation of it to find
it. I think, Dave, I've forgotten what it was like before I started doing all of this work for me personally, because I reacted the same way that the people that I'm working with react when we're dealing with the big picture, where I just get completely stumped when I looked at something needs to be done and I didn't even, all I could see was the end and I knew I couldn't get there.
Uh-huh. And at what point are you reflecting back and resonating with that experience, the beginning of what endeavors?
When I started just with the coaching.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, and I've done several courses since then in different areas. And I learned to live in the moment. And for me, that allows me then to move forward with ease.
Uh-huh.
And I've forgotten, and that just brought it to the surface again, that I had forgotten what it was like for me when I couldn't get anything accomplished because I was so fearful of the future.
Yeah, and just the massive amount of material when you look at it in a big picture and abstractly without looking at what's next. I mean, I remember way back in college, I would take my stuff to the academic center and sit down and get all set up, and then be amazed at how much material there was and promptly take a nap. I mean, I attacked it right away. It was just too much. So I think that's a common experience that we all have, and I think we can really resonate with clients who need to look at, you know, what's the next step and then what's the next step after that. So
mm-hmm.
that's a great reminder. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
How's your practice coming?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Sorry. With my clients?
Uh-huh.
My practice is, I honestly have to say I don't have the marketing skills that I would like to have. And that area I really need to focus on next. And I keep saying, well, I'll take this and I'll do this course and I'll do that. And then all of a sudden I realize here, just at the same time that I began your course, was that the next one has to be marketing.
Ah, uh-huh.
To draw people in. I have connections and I get people through that, but I want it bigger than that. I don't want to have to rely on the same people to bring my clients to me.
Uh-huh.
So like, I tried advertising a long time ago and that wasn't effective. But,
yeah,
you know, if, pardon me?
That doesn't work. I've never heard anybody put an ad somewhere who's had a positive response. Now, I have heard of, you know, certainly, you know, nice responses from Facebook, from LinkedIn, from the, you know, business networking like LinkedIn, but not advertising, because this is really a personal relationship you have with someone, and it's based on a relationship often by referral, so it just doesn't work that way. So what have you done that has worked?
The referrals has worked.
Uh-huh.
And the connections that I have with groups around the United States, that has worked really well. I'm not going to be traveling as much as I had, so I really wanted to look at the whole marketing thing where I don't have to, you know, do that much legwork and go out there and, you know, the referrals come in, but I want another avenue to draw people in.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Actually, what I would like to do is build the business where I have other people working for me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can I have a virtual firm?
A virtual firm is probably the ideal thing for me.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a real possibility to, you know, to have a, you know, a group of people, coaches and other professionals who you can bring in and do a turnkey operation and get a percentage of what they do or however you work it. Are you thinking about billing for them or just doing a percentage?
I was thinking about doing a percentage, but when you say that, billing for them, I could do that too. That's not something that's outside
of my... There's different ways to go,
and
two very different structures, but either one can work well. I have a buddy who has, I think he has a 9-person virtual firm. He does executive coaching, and he'll go in and assess needs, and he may do one aspect. He may do, say, work with the executive team or with the CEO, and will bring in other people, other coaches. He has a number of other people from, you know, people who do group work, who do 360s, who do cultural assessments, people who do tests, you know, like the DISC. He even has an attorney and a CPA and a person who does work with merging company. I mean, so he has a large number, and he does 25%. He takes 25% of what is referred, and he will often help someone get up to the price that they should be charging, so they'll make as much as they were planning on, and he gets 20 because he oversees and knows who to bring in and who to parachute in for what, and it's a huge service for the company because they don't know how to bring in who and how to coordinate and synthesize that and what to do with the results. So it's a huge, huge benefit in doing that. And someone else I know who does billing, you know, a couple of the big firms, I'm an affiliate of a couple of these, CoachSource on the West Coast, does billing, and you get a percentage of that, like 75% or, you know, something like that. And that's Marshall Goldsmith's Evolve firm, the kind of the guy who started executive coaching. So there are a lot of different ways to go. You know, the simplest way is to begin with, you know, going to your local ICF chapter, and there's a big one in Denver. Probably the first or second largest in the country is in Denver. I've spoken there, and I recently did a presentation, a teleseminar on Master States of Mind to that group. So I know a number of the people fairly well. And to get to know people and to do referral fees, to get and give referral fees. And it's a great way to do it with a coaching group like that. Have you done that?
With the ICF, no.
Uh-huh, the Denver Coaches Group?
I haven't. And the reason I haven't is because I don't drive.
Oh,
I don't drive, so it's funny because most of my travels have been, well, all of them are really by explain. And I'm definitely tied up with the Better Business Bureau and things like that. But when I gave up driving, it kind of cut all of that off. I was going to ask, Dave, did you do the DISC program?
No, I don't. I have I have somebody I call in to do that, or I can administer it and get them to score it. I've used it only a couple of times, but no, I don't.
I asked only because I had done it through, I believe it was Coach Trading Alliance, and I had done that program. And when you mentioned it, I thought, I wonder if that was you, but perhaps not.
It was Dave Meyer.
It was the other Dave, right?
Yeah. Now, how do you how do you get into to the airport from Loveland if you don't drive?
I have people that I rely on to drive me around.
Great. That's great.
I know. And then when I get somewhere, it's real easy because then I can just hire a car. So that's always nice.
That's my fantasy. You know, bring my driver around. Yes, sir.
Go.
All right. That sounds good to me. I'm going to fit that right in with a month of skiing in Steamboat and a month in either New Orleans or on the coast of Maine riding every year. So thank you. My stretch goals have expanded.
I think mine just did.
Yeah. Do either of you watch Suits, the show on TV?
No.
He has a driver. Yeah. So my fantasy got torqued there.
There you go.
Diane or Diane present and want to check in?
Yep, Diane's here. Sorry, I was...
Welcome. How are you? Bring us up to date.
I'm doing okay. Sorry, I was a little late because on a, don't mean to be negative, but a sort of a friend of my daughter's from grade school was just killed in a car accident. So we were just over there bringing some and everything. So it was the only time we could do it together.
Yeah.
So that was just sad, drunk driver kind of thing. But anyway, just a really week. But aside from that, I'm okay. Sorry, so
great.
I just was, we were a little late, and I'm just transitioning a bit from that. But
well,
I
whenever you feel like joining in and getting the flow of it, that's great.
Yep, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, super. Has Lynn arrived?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Bring us up to date for you.
As far as my storytelling, money story, everything is good. I've been really busy over the weekend with my son, with the clinic and Emerge, and that is just, he's just kind of fighting a flu. He's been fighting it for like 3 weeks. We're just making sure it's flu and nothing serious. But as far as my goals that I had set for my money story, my map, I'm basically haven't been able to find the time right now to get on board with that, but I'm gonna refocus tomorrow. He's feeling a little bit better, so and get some of the stuff in before Christmas. So and some of it was doing my website, so I'm refocusing on that to get that done.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the progress note. Anything that has come up in your work with clients or in the reading that you'd like to talk about briefly before Chris presents his roadmap? Any challenges with clients, for example? Okay. Chris, would you do your roadmap for us?
Certainly. Be glad to. And again, y'all bear with me. My voice is on Dave earlier. I was downstairs gargling for about 30 minutes, so hopefully it'll hang in there a little bit. But basically, you know, I've been blessed with a lot of good role models in making financial decisions over the course of my life, which has been my dad, close friends, industry-associated colleagues, people I respect in the industry, and several people. So I've had access to very good sounding boards for making financial decisions. However, what I've realized through this process is that there was no structure, there was just no way to, organize future financial goals. My dad grew up through the Great Depression, and so we came from quite a conservative family. A lot of our decisions were, in fact, nearly all of our financial decisions were openly discussed. Excuse me just a minute. So sorry about that. But a lot of our financial decisions were just openly discussed, even as small as minor things like buying clothes. I have an old girlfriend that still remembers a lengthy conversation we had at the dinner table about a pair of shoes that I bought. So anyway, it was we had those. That's a little bit of the demonstrates a little bit of the conservative foundation that I grew up with. Then as my career took off, money started flowing to me at. And my business is commission sales only, so there's no consistency to when my revenue comes in. As a result, it just ebbs and flows, and that's, you know, I thought, well, sort of I had always understood that the definition of to be rich is, you know, when you have enough money to pay your expenses. That program doesn't exactly work very well for long-term planning. But anyway, I realized that my personality and confidence would ebb and flow with the amount of money that I had in the bank. And the ability to balance the inconsistency without a structure was really affecting me emotionally. So basically, I was a rudderless ship, just kind of vulnerable to whichever way the winds were blowing. They were completely out of my control. I've always accepted the fact that anything I own, whether it's a car, a house, or anything major, I'm accountable for maintaining those things. Until now, I've not really had a way to look at my financial situations with the same sense of accountability. It just seemed to maintain itself as long as the revenue was there. That seems to have been not really much of a problem. As I mentioned, you know, I felt like the definition of being rich was being able to have enough income to cover your expenses, and that was a belief that drove my behavior for a long time. You know, it worked well, but it doesn't work well for unexpected expenses or, you know, if you're trying to do any kind of a long-term planning. Commercial real estate is my business, and it's allowed me the opportunity I have great years, but it comes with great risk. First 10 years of my career, money was coming to me very easy. I was making more than I could ever really imagine. The late 1980s, however, really humbled me when the real estate market collapsed. I was fortunate, didn't have to file bankruptcy, but I was right on the cusp of it. And I vowed that I would never put myself in that situation again. And I was further humbled a few years after that with a very costly divorce. My ex-wife was very financially irresponsible and really quite deceitful in some of her purchases that I never knew about. Anyway, so I've been in a rebuilding mode ever since then. Fortunately, my current wife I've known for over 40 years, we've been married for a little over 13. She also came from a costly divorce, but the blessing is she's financially responsible. And I'd say together we've made pretty good progress in rebuilding. However, our financial, you know, planning has been still without any kind of a disciplined plan. And the advice we've been given, it's been very expensive. So as my commission income fluctuates with the market, the market conditions are something I can't change. So I've always had to accept the fact that there'll be some good years and some bad years. But that inconsistency, I've been doing this for 35 years, so this inconsistency, over that long a period of time, you learn to balance. And I recognize how the influence affects me emotionally and how emotion has played on our discretionary spending. There was a lot of acquisitions we made. Looked at it differently, we probably wouldn't have made. Going forward, though, you know, we'll compare what are our ideals and needs with any financial decision we make. And the way my wife and I term it is we look at things from the balcony because it's a perspective that you see things differently. On the balcony, you can see how a play is really playing out as opposed to being up front or close or even on the stage. You just don't see how the play evolves. And so we step out and look at things from the balcony. And that's not just financial decisions. It's a lot of different things that we use that term to do. You know, that approach also lessens our vulnerability to making emotional decisions when we're looking at it from the balcony. But we will be focusing on the end value as we make future decisions. Additionally, time will be our friend, and we'll look at it as a friend, not a vice. There, a lot of times with our planning, there was the need to make quick decisions. And anytime you're involved in making a quick decision, emotion is usually lingering there somewhere. And so we've now established budgets that we use as benchmarks to bump our decisions up against. Taking our, you know, to kind of map out the changes we're going to do going forward, we're taking our financial decisions really off autopilot, which is kind of how they've been. As long as the money was there, it was easy to make decisions. But there was no long-range planning. So putting things on QuickBooks, so we're really understanding our expenses and just basically taking charge of our own cash flow. And we're dedicating to a budget. We're also transitioning out of stocks and bonds that we're in. We're deeply invested in that, and we have no idea, totally vulnerable to anybody's suggestions. So anyway, we're transitioning from that into real estate assets, which is something, based on my career, I've got the ability to influence, and no more emotional decisions being made. The new money story that, you know, I desire is based on a balance between continued financial independence, stress in my real estate practice, and which I plan to phase down. My goal is to phase down my real estate practice and offset the revenue with coaching. My practice has always been centered, focused on the client, and I've always found that personally satisfying. That's why I think coaching will be a good complement to that, using my experience. Again, my business, it's a high-profile business on the commercial side. My identity in my business is important. However, my identity, I expect it to be more emotionally confident, you know, as I reveal and start living my new money story, certainly with a financially organized discipline. And accepting the accountability I have for finances has opened my eyes to the importance of taking control of it and saving money that otherwise we would have spent on desires. And I will be more relaxed with less stress as I move from the pressure of my real estate practice to coaching, especially as I've got a financial plan with a structure that my wife and I both support. So based on that, I look forward to my new profile.
Thank you very much. That's very insightful and mentally reflective. And it's an interesting example of a collaborative model of moving to and infusing this throughout with a collaboration with your wife, and to keep that open and in a discussion mode. Thank you very much. That was a really amazingly insightful and powerful story. Congratulations.
I
got
to say the sector size that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I say congratulations on the work you put into it.
Oh, thank you very much. I got to say the exercise was really, it does cause you to deeply reflect on, you know, where you've been and say, okay, that path is over and now I'm creating a new path. I've gotten a lot out of this.
Great. Want to take any questions or reflections from anyone else about it?
I have a question. I have a question for Chris.
Yes.
Chris, I was wondering, you made a statement and it resonated very deeply with me, so I was wondering where you are on the other side of the statement. You said that your confidence would ebb and flow with the amount of money in the bank.
Right.
And you said that past tense, so I was wondering where you are with that now.
Well, I think through this exercise, it's opened my eyes to see the impact emotion has had on me. I've known this for a long time, you know, that I tend to get more frustrated when I see bills and look in the bank and, I've, you know, the money's just not there to pay it. And so we're pulling it from different sources. So I think part of it, if I'm talking about it in the past, it's because some of that is just self-conditioning my mind to be more positive about recognizing the emotion and how it does play effect on when I see things, you know, they don't have funds in the bank to cover expenses, and how to I've recognized it. I guess I've always known it, but I've brought it more to attention and in focus. That's how I've been able to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Good question.
I have a question, or maybe just a clarification. I'm not sure that being in commercial real estate and moving forward in a different money story, but getting out of the market and almost getting back into real estate, I'm just a little bit confused about that.
Okay. My practice is I'm on the brokerage side of it, so I'm representing corporations
okay.
that have the need for basically my specializations, warehouses and manufacturing plants and distribution centers. So I'm representing corporations in their need for space. So from that standpoint, that part of my practice, the brokerage side of it, I really plan to phase that down. And where we're transitioning from our personal stock portfolio, our portfolio being involved in stocks and bonds, transitioning that to, you know, getting out of being dependent upon a financial advisor to say, oh, well, you need to buy this stock and that stock, which we don't have a clue about. But changing that where we're, instead of owning stocks, we'll own real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be more income-producing real estate as opposed to stocks and bonds. Because, you know, if it's any kind of real estate, if it starts having financial trouble or the market goes south or whatever, there's a lot of things I can do through my marketing experience. I can reposition the real estate, a piece of real estate. I don't have any influence. It's come totally out of my control as a stock fluctuates with the market.
Okay.
That's a really interesting way to actively seize and be effective in what you're doing, and moving from a passive to a very active position. So I can see where that would have a very different kind of mindset as well as effectiveness overall. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, I agree with you. I guess I'm coming from a little bit of a different angle from real estate, and so I was curious about getting back into it at this point, but I won't belinger it, but because that's what you know, obviously you can just use that knowledge in a different way for more security. So it seems as if it really makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's just been vulnerable for a long time to the advice that we've had to take from financial advisors. Well, not knocking them, but it's just that when it comes to, we sit down and we'll meet with our financial advisor, and he'll say, okay, well, we need to move into this, this, and this. And, you know, we just have to sit there and look at each other and go, okay. So I'd rather be able to evaluate a piece of property through the eyes and experience that I've had and size it up and say, yeah, I think this would be a good investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at another point we could share. I went through some of that with advisors, and it was very frustrating, and so I have just decided that there's a mixed interest with most advisors, because whether you make money or lose money, they make money. So that's the biggest problem. You know what? It's win-win for them, and it can be win-lose for you. So, yes, I live in a place where I totally understand that, because it's one of the capitals in the world, basically, and I see so much of this, and it's really frustrating. So I agree with you.
Yeah, that's interesting too. Any other aspects of that would be of interest to discuss or to discuss with Chris? Obviously, very stimulating, Chris. Thank you very, very much, and for the openness and honesty about that, and sharing it with us and letting us interact around that. It's immensely valuable for each of us, I think, in doing it that way. So thank you very, very much.
Good. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about the specific module and the seminar on your money story. Now, some of you have done this already with your roadmap, but I'd like you to write down three questions. First, what's your money story? Now, by that, I don't mean your income, your expenses, your assets, your debt, but your relationship with money and the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. And secondly, what do you consider a healthy relationship with money? These are not easy and obvious answers, I don't expect. And three, what would you ideally like your money story to be? You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often it's not visible to us, the author of it. It's a story that you talk about every day, that you think about several times a day. It's remarkably simple, yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. And it's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, and even unconscious. And this story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. You engage it every day of your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. Maybe you'll get 10 years out of a car. Maybe 40 years with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. And you alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of your life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted by this story. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your moods, increase or adjust self-esteem, influence others, or soothe emotional pains. And here's the lifeline clue. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you, and you speak with it. And, of course, it's your money story. So as we consider these two questions, what's your money story, and what would you ideally like your money story to be? As I mentioned, your money story is not your income, your bank account, your investment portfolio. Your money story is the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, and what you think money says about you. And it's a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you believe you're capable of. And it's also, in a way, about what would happen if you had more or less. Now, think about, with me, all the ways that we speak with money. One way is straightforward. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. The wonder of money is it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what at times we idealize and desire, yet what we fear and lack, or even what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We use money to show how much we care or how little. We can use it to measure success, to try to buy happiness, to try to adjust self-esteem, regulate moods, even influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. We speak with money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it. We give it emotional value. We build a relationship with it and make it bigger than it really is. We use money to do a number of things that is totally beyond the simple medium of exchange that money is. We speak with money as a self-statement. And money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story really manifests through self-statements. And, of course, the story always tells most about the teller. Some examples of self-statements of money. Proclamation of freedom. Assurance of love. Embodiment of power. Affirmation of autonomy. Evidence of security. Proof of worth. License for opportunity. To foster alliances or exclusions. As an instrument of control. For example, when we see a new car and want it, what we're really doing is acting on our money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that says, perhaps this car will really show what I'm worth. This will make it much easier so I can focus on this instead of worrying about my other car. This will make people respect me. This will validate me. Another obvious example is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW 535 and drive it down the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW 535 in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a self-statement. I'd never buy a red car. Now, without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. We also use money in self-talk, the messages we tell ourselves. These internal beliefs may include people who have significant money are lucky. People with money are really different than me. You have to really work hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money could really make me happier. Money means the same to everyone. Our money stories are a large part of our life stories. Some of the money issues are really about money, but many, most in fact, are about other matters, private or even secret, that hitchhike on money. We take money, the tool, way too seriously. We don't take our money stories seriously enough to recognize that we write them, live them, and can revise them. And it's hard to get money just right. It may occupy too much of our lives or too little. Its importance may inhabit too large a space or too small. Now, let's consider the inner dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create really unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? And you may not see dessert. An agent at a writer's conference discussed working with her authors over the years. This was an internationally known agent who was meeting with a group of authors. I was in attendance. She talked about the details of her contract negotiations. And finally, someone in the audience said, would you talk about how much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? She looked shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself, and then somebody else in the audience said, well, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of those sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter talked about specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion that was really useful to her audience, many of whom were interested in writing books for a living. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. That was exactly one century ago, the year 1913, the therapist Sigmund Freud. A century later, most of us have learned to talk more easily about sex, yet remain seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own money stories or of our debt stories. The first book I did about money had this quote from Freud on the front flap. The book was called The Last Taboo. And at that time, and this was interesting to me at the time, I was on a panel a couple of years earlier about money, and they asked for references, and none of us had any references because there was nothing written about money. In fact, before The Last Taboo came out in 1986, there was one book written about 20 years earlier by a psychoanalyst about the symbolic meaning of money. Nothing else was written, and it's something that therapists and analysts and their patients deal with or talk about every day. So that was striking, that that was only the second book in existence on money and fee in psychotherapy. Now, while we may not speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We create internal and external conversations about money. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, which is really to say our time and energy, for something else. And every exchange involves two prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. Some examples of this. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. When school started, I joined my classmates, and after lunch, we went to the concession stand. They bought sodas and candies, and I did too. And immediately, when I started eating these, it dawned on me, was this candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? And will I get enough from this soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? And really quickly, I answered no to both questions, no candies and sodas for me. I learned the cost of money. You know, often we talk about the value of money and do things like I did with my kids, close allowances so I could be, instead of an authority and saying yes or no, a collaborator about is two alligators worth the same as one horse and pony, and, you know, things like that. But this also is about what money costs, because we always have to pay for money. Another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. The preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on a big screen HD TV, but if I spread it out over 11 years, if I amortize it, it's only 19 cents a day. And then my wife said, Dave, if you want the TV, just go ahead and buy it. Now, another aspect is we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money, pretty much spent without debate. Salary money or professional fee or commission, only after serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement money, only with definite need or emergency. And it's the same dollar. The dollar doesn't even know who owns it any more than war bonds knew about the war. It's a framing bias that the meaning of the dollar bill is determined by the frame around it, or at least our emotional regard of it is determined by that. Another example, the spender. The high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. This was a quote on a documentary of someone about to file their fourth bankruptcy. Or the parent, spending money makes me feel like I'm providing for my family because I spend so much time at work, when I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it. Now, and again, if you have questions or things to add or ask, just jump in. And I'm interested in your perspectives as well. But let's talk briefly about how money speaks to us. Money sometimes speaks to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us as confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, drug. Money serves as a tangible container for a whole number of things: hope, freedom, ambition, love, disappointment. It can become a currency of caring, a symbol of success, a measure of power. So many different aspects of meaning can be assigned. We make money mistakes because we use money to accomplish non-financial goals. We seek to use money as the thing that no thing can actually do. Regulate our moods, increase our self-esteem, influence others. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains and buy the respect of others and ourselves. In other words, we give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship, and make it bigger or sometimes different than it really is. And the more we give money meaning, the more we lose our focus on what it really means. And then we do some really strange things with money. For example, intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people can get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. I've worked as a mentor coach with two Madoff victims, very well-known, very sophisticated people that were huge victims of Madoff. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Otherwise, gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise, balanced individuals may spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Dependable people can ignore financial matters until they become serious. Highly principled individuals can step over boundaries and write their own rules about money. And the messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to. Why is our money story so important? Well, one aspect is it permeates everything we do. It ghostwrites every aspect of our lives. As I mentioned, what we eat, drink, read, fear, plan, buy, all are affected by our money story. Our health, our jobs, our families, our dreams, all are impacted in some way by our money story. Day by day, thought by thought, dollar by dollar, our money story becomes our life story. It's also important for another reason. The money story we each live will be the one that we teach our children and our clients and our employees. When we talk about money, our experiences and ideas regarding money, we're really talking about ourselves. A money story reveals our relationship to ourselves as well as to money. So this is for those who want to learn about themselves and how much a money story articulates a life story. Now, a note about, again, the power of story applied here. A study in which volunteers had their brains scanned using fMRI scans when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon, and each were identified by different prices. The tasters knew in the study the price of each of the 5 wines. Now, they rated the wines, and as you might expect, they rated the most expensive wine as the most favorite, the best tasting, and on down sequentially to the cheapest wine was the least preferable. And the volunteers showed the same pattern in their brains. In other words, the most expensive wine that they liked the most showed the most activation in the pleasure center and on down in sequence to the least expensive. Now, the volunteers actually tasted one wine with five different stories. They actually experienced more pleasure, and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. I want to highlight one aspect of what is in your workbook, the answer to question number 3 on the money quiz. Money means to me. Now, here, the one word that comes to your mind shows how money can make any statement. Some of the most common variations of one-word responses: worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs can show up as symbolic wants. And a desire is not quieted by its satisfaction. In fact, desires can be created by filling them. Marketers know this. And money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But when we're offered the chance to imbue the design with meaning, the interpretation is going to be as wishful and varied as the fantasies of each of the respondents. Money equations. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth, and it varies according to their bank account, or their morals. One woman said, "You know, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I should have good money." Well, we know money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps you money. Or related to their ethics. In fact, President Obama said, "If you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor." Well, now we know better than that. You may work hard, but overspend, gamble, have 5 children, 3 of whom are college age, live in Midtown Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction, to name a few. As a sidebar, little quiz here to make a point. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic? I'm interested in your responses on this. If you cast a broad net and look at all, you know, cultures, jobs, groups of people, who in America do you think has the best work ethic? Any thoughts or guesses?
Are you talking about like a certain nationality or something like that?
Could be. I mean, anything, any job or culture or nationality or industry? Any guesses?
I'm a heroin addict.
Heroin addicts. Somebody has, somebody has listened to my presentation before. Yes.
Absolutely.
They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week and holidays. In fact, one heroin addict put it this way: "I have to get up every day at the crack of dawn and hustle all day long. Every day of the year. If I don't, the next day, I don't lose my self-esteem. The next day, I die." Now, I emphasize that to highlight the difference between work ethic and performance or success ethic. Kind of, you know, you've heard somebody say, "Well, you know, I was at my desk for 10 hours yesterday." Well, that's a work ethic, but that's not exactly synonymous with performance ethic or success ethic. And what we do in coaching is to help people really embrace the outcome, the success, the performance, rather than looking at work as an end in itself or idealizing the work ethic component. Let's talk for just a moment about a debt story. If money were about math, we wouldn't need to be talking. If money were about math, no one would have at least personal debt. But more than math, money is about emotions and psychology. It's about each individual money story. The average American family has 6 credit cards carrying an unpaid balance of more than $9,000. For these families, if they pay off their balances by making the minimum payments each month, it would take almost a century. The debt story is a strange, addictive world, or can be, of spending and debt. And money's become more abstract, such as using credit cards. And our debt has soared. In fact, just a brief history of money, since you ask. Money initially didn't exist. It was the barter system. People, you know, two goats would be traded for five bags of rice. Then coins were struck to be the value of the coin. Then symbols came into play, paper bills, then checks, then plastic. Now a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money has become more abstracted, our understanding of our relationship with money can fade. The vast majority of our money management is not through our hands, bank's hands, our broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't. The components that work don't need fixing. The ones that don't work need to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life. And your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story, and especially discerning what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. Now, here's an example of hitchhiking. I think most of you have heard me use the mention the study from Wharton School of Business, surveyed several thousand professionals to examine the major factor that determined whether somebody engaged or declined services from the professional. More than years of experience, reputation, amount of the fee, degrees and certifications, and state of the economy was one simple variable, stating the recommendations and fee clearly and confidently. And that confidence is what generates the response from potential clients. In fact, another study, Carnegie Mellon, did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others. More than these three factors combined, an established proven expert, demonstrated current expertise, reputation and credentials was one factor, again, equal to all three of these others combined, the confidence that the professional exhibited. It's the kind of communication midbrain to midbrain that when we see someone who has confidence, we resonate with that and want to become part of that. And what Wharton School of Business found, and remember from when I mentioned it before, the credibility of professionals is hurt if they're fuzzy about fees. It damages the trust a client has. And for most people, the issue, far more than whether fees were high or low, was that the professional was clear, direct, and confident about recommendations and fees. This is an example, I think. This is an explanation, although neither of these studies mention this as a reason. This is an explanation, I think, from a different perspective. Subliminal language. And this is what's conveyed in that the professional is confident in stating recommendations and fees. And here's an example of I believe how that works. A series of studies was reported by Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard, where he showed volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. It was like 1/50th of a second. So it was subliminal programming. They could not pick, they didn't know that this was happening. They couldn't pick the word out among several in a multiple choice. So they were unaware that this was happening. Yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers walked more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, they would perform less well on tests. And this impact fact lasted between 40 and 55 minutes after the word was flashed. Now, when these volunteers were asked why they responded in this way, first they were unaware of it. And then when they were shown, for example, they were shown the film, the before and after of walking more slowly, and told that they were given that subliminal cue of elderly and that that was cause and effect, they did not believe it. In fact, they denied that that was the cause and effect. They said, no, I've been jet-lagged or haven't been sleeping well or a number of other factors. What this does, I believe, is to demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure, for the brain to end any dissonance and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation that makes sense to us. It infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness to be able to explain and to explain in our own system. And that's where we can create a cause and effect and then generate a confirmation bias and not see things that create an inattentional blindness and not see things that would refute our theory so that it becomes self-fulfilling. Let me give you another example of this from a totally different perspective. As an explorer, Columbus was an average sailor by all accounts. But in one area, he was a genius. People believed in him. He had a curious kind of confidence. He projected a sense of confidence that was completely out of proportion to his means. It was a quiet and calm self-assurance. In fact, it was the same confidence usually shown by the nobility themselves. And the powerful in the old-style aristocracies felt no need to prove or assert or sell themselves. Being noble, they felt entitled. They felt they deserved more and asked for it. Columbus got full funding from the Queen of England to sail not one but three ships on the basis of an idea. And it was really a goofy idea, an eyebrow raiser and an eyeball roller combined, to find a new world. And that was when the Flat Earth Society didn't even need to be a society because everybody belonged. But Columbus taught others how to respond to him by believing in himself. So the most important person to convince about, for example, your professional fee is yourself. When you value your services, others will too. And remember, it's up to you to set your own price. Ask for less, and that's exactly what you'll get. Ask for more, and you send a signal that you're worth it. Even those who turn you down respect you for your confidence, and that respect will pay off in ways that you can't now imagine. Any thoughts or comments about any of this? Does this make sense to you, and does this fit with how you're seeing things? A resounding yes?
I agree. I think it's consistent because our brains program, you know, they respond to whether it's pre-programming, you know, who knows, to what's perceived value. And so if you value yourself, you value your time, you have the confidence, you have the ideas, that's contagious and people will buy in. I mean, it's part of the venture capital world, you know, without a doubt, you know. So it clearly makes sense. But if you don't believe in your idea, you don't believe in your own value, no one else is going to buy into that because what you're selling is yourself.
Exactly. And you mentioned contagion. It is contagious. And that kind of emotional contagion we know a lot more about now, in terms of social and emotional intelligence, and from neuroscience, how that emotional contagion goes from amygdala to amygdala and incorporates and involves our energy fields. So I think that is more explainable now. It's measurable in some ways, but I think we're going to see in the future a significant advancement in terms of what we understand about phenomena like that. But this is a practical way that we can know and use now, as you mentioned, in terms of confidence, in terms of really being and providing for our clients what they can live into. And what you can do for your clients is to believe in them, and then they'll teach you both why. You know, think about as coaches what we do is in some ways what we did for our children as parents. I believe that the most important thing I could do for my children was to believe in them and that they would live into that and teach us both why. And that became very much the basis of our relationship. And I do believe the same in coaching, and that's why I don't work with anyone in whom I don't believe. That I think believing in that person is the most important thing I can do, and that's what's happening while we're going to be talking about other things. What we talk about is important, but that's really important as well. Yeah, so thanks for that comment.
I'm sorry, you just went over it sort of fast, and if you don't mind just reiterating it,
sure.
Regarding emotions and the energy fields. Say that again.
Well, what we know now in terms of communication is that there's emotional contagion, that we communicate from amygdala to amygdala. For example, whenever two people are in empathic resonance with one another, if you measure both of their fMRIs, there's a synchrony, kind of like they're playing, the brain waves look like they're playing the same music. There's a synchrony. And this was just demonstrated out of Princeton. And when one stops listening or there's a derailment of that empathic connection, it stops amazingly quickly. It just like somebody stopped playing the music. So that's one way of measuring and knowing that. There are aspects, as remember we talked about, Einstein's concept of the unified field theory, that we are each bundles of energy and we relate to another bundle of energy, another person, and those energy fields interact, and we also, with our energy field, interact with the larger group as well, and that those have powerful influences. You know, for example, something I've done, you know, in a retreat or do with an audience is to have I don't think I've mentioned this before, is to ask for a volunteer, to demonstrate, kind of a goofy way of demonstrating the power of this, is to ask for a volunteer and ask for them to if they're right-handed, to hold out their left hand and to resist me pushing down their hand. And with one of my hands, they can pretty well resist to a good degree me pushing down their hands. I can get it down, but they can resist it with reasonable effort. Now, if I ask the group to send very powerful and positive thoughts to that person, positive energy, think positive thoughts directed specifically at that person, then despite my best effort with one arm, I can't push down their arm. Now, if I ask the group send negative energy, negative thoughts to that person, I can push your arm down with one finger. Now, think about the implications of applications of that. Home and away games. The Rockets, they are second in the NBA in home games and 28th in the NBA in away games. People usually lose, average teams, or teams on the average, lose twice as many games away as they do home games. Positive energy. And the teams that can regulate this energy field and know how to do that, know about this phenomenon, can do amazingly well either place.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So just a couple of other aspects I wanted to mention about the really mind matters and brain business. Because so many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how our minds and brains work. And so much of strategic coaching, especially informed by neuroscience and quantum physics, have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. For example, how do our brains work against us in creating money stories? Well, each part struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. The two aspects of our brain. A company increases profits 26 quarters in a row. Projected earnings are this quarter at 24 cents. They announce earnings instead of 23 cents, meaning that the analyst just messed up and got it wrong. But instead, the company loses $1.5 billion in market value in the next 5 minutes. Now, did the mindset of the investors change, or did the company's intrinsic value change? Emotions can corrupt decision-making and cause a focus on the immediate. We usually focus on the immediate. What's salient, it has that emotional charge, instead of keeping the big picture. But people who feel no emotion are not good at making decisions also, on the other hand. So, money is a magnifier, and like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person is a problem drinker, excess money will make them more drunk, usually. If someone is insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone is caring and generous, money can help them be a better philanthropist. And to reiterate something I think you've heard me say before, it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. And as we've already heard, you can roadmap your money story. And that, I think, can be a very useful exercise because it's a real challenge to be objective about our own story, especially about our money story. One of the people whose names you would recognize as an international publisher was talking to me, and he said it so simply and so eloquently. He said, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell my money story to myself in order to know what to change." And that's exactly what we're addressing here. And that includes, you know, life, relationship, career, wellness, other stories. Today we've been focusing on money story, to really know how to tell your money story to yourself, to know how to listen and help someone understand their relationship with money, and to create a revised or new money story for your clients. Your thoughts and comments or questions about anything we've talked about?
So, Dave, one thing I'll throw in there now that came to mind as you were talking through some of this about how money has influenced kids.
Uh-huh.
We have a situation in our family where my ex-wife's mother just doted clothes, you know, movies, whatever, on our daughter. She's now 28. And, you know, my mother chose to not go that route. She chose to show her how to cook, how to, you know, sew and do some, you know, more anything that didn't evolve.
Stuff that will work in the real world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the hard part about it, though, is our daughter is closer aligned with my my ex-wife's mother.
Mm.
And that's been very frustrating through that process.
Yeah. That's tough. You know, when an attachment pattern with someone involves money in the way that you describe, it really complicates both the relationship and money.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, occludes the real purity and value of each by fusing the two like that.
There was a consistent pattern there because I remember my mother-in-law telling me that, you know, whenever she worked at a bank, and so whenever my wife would go overdrawn when she was in college, you know, the banker would come down and say, "Well, your daughter hit the honor roll today," and she would laugh and go put money in her account. So there was no financial responsibility as she was growing up, which was reflective also in our marriage.
That's what you said in the roadmap that you did. Yeah. So that kind of attachment pattern to money repeated itself, and you have a challenge for it not to be repeated with your daughter in the relationship with her grandma. That's
the only way
a challenge.
The only way we're combating it is just drawing attention to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And creating natural consequences, which is what the real world is about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that some of this, too, is perpetuated with women with the amount of media that, you know, it's a more complex issue. But so some of the age that she's at is this power that she can articulate herself with buying her identity. And the mother-in-law perhaps is, that's how she's trying to buy love or redefine herself. And sometimes the topics that you choose with your daughter and the questions you ask about that bigger picture may resonate with her more, because I see similar patterns, and I have a daughter who's not quite that old, but it's very interesting when they begin to look at what's going on with women in the whole world and pay attention to that and connect with that more so, that they may find she may be making better choices than she is currently.
Mm.
So just a suggestion.
Well, that's good. That's good input.
Right. Okay, well, we'll have to stop here. Well, I hope each of you have terrific holidays, and I look forward to picking up with you after the holidays. Have great, great times with families and holidays.
What's the next date, Paul?
I'm sorry, was there a question?
Yeah, what's the next date for our call?
January the 8th.
Got it.
Yeah.
And not too much spending on gifts.
Okay. Great holidays, guys. See you now. Enjoyed it.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Bye.
Bye. Merry Christmas.